Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Masters in Business is brought to you by the American Arbitration Association. Business disputes are inevitable. Resolve faster with the American Arbitration Association, the global leader in alternative dispute resolution for over 90 years. Learn more at ADR.org.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This week on the podcast, I have a special guest. His name is Chris Anderson. He is the founder of 3D Robotics. He was formerly editor-in-chief of Wired magazine, and he is the author of the book, The Long Tail. Chris Anderson has been at the forefront of technology for a good couple of decades. He saw pretty much where the industry has been going long before the bulk of the public has figured it out. He has tremendous insight into why certain things are as valuable as they are, and why certain products, industries, sectors, software, gadgets, etc., are capable of achieving mass acceptance. I find him to be consistently insightful and forward-looking, and I don't know anybody else who's quite had his vantage point throughout the 90s, 2000s, and beyond. He really has seen a lot of things coming before anybody else did. 3D Robotics, as an example, started out as a DIY drone company, and they just got so overwhelmed with orders that they pivoted to being a drone manufacturer, and now they're a drone software creator. Really, really fascinating stuff. If you are at all interested in technology, drones, software, this is the sort of conversation that you're going to really enjoy. So with no further ado, my interview with Chris Anderson. My special guest today is someone I've known for a long time and have been a big fan of his work for all these many years. His name is Chris Anderson. He is the former editor-in-chief at Wired magazine, worked as a journalist and editor at The Economist for 7 years. He is the author of several books, including the New York Times bestseller, The Long Tail. Presently, he is CEO and founder of 3D Robotics, which is a drone and software company. The Long Tail, you probably are familiar with it from either the original Wired article or the book itself. The book won the Loeb Award for the best business book of the year in 2007. He has been named to all manner of lists, one of Time Magazine's 100 most influential people, Tech 40, the most influential minds in technology, foreign policies, global thinkers. Chris Anderson, welcome to Bloomberg Radio. And let me add, thank you for having us here in the 3D Robotics headquarters.
Barry, it's just great to have you on our coast.
It's a pleasure out here to be out here, and I travel all over and don't frequently say, I could live in this climate, and this is one of those places where, yeah, I could live here if I had to.
So it's
if
worth
I had to adapt.
It's worth noting you're in Berkeley,
yes.
Which is the nicest part of the Bay Area.
Is it?
Do you say so, yeah.
It's a little cooler here than down in Palo Alto.
Normally it's a little, it's cooler than Palo Alto, but warmer than the city.
Okay, there you go. So let's jump right into it. You have a really unusual background. You studied quantum mechanics and science journalism. Some people do science and some people do journalism. Not a lot of people do both. How did you find your way to marry those two fields?
I didn't actually study either of them properly. My degree is in computational physics.
Okay.
And, but it just so happened that in writing up my resume, I happened to have taken a class in science journalism, which at the time seemed the only link I had to journalism, so I stuck it on my resume. But no, my degree is in computational
physics. So your whole career is a charade. Is that what you're...
It is. It is. No, you know, in its big dimensions, it doesn't make a lot of sense. I went from physics to ultimately ended up working for a fashion company. It's Condé Nast, but you know, fashion advertising is the main revenue driver.
Okay, but they're a little more than a fashion. They're a lot more fine publications.
Indeed, and it's not fair to Condé Nast to call it. But when you're in the, you know, the elevators of what at the time was four Times Square, and it's supermodels up and down, you ask yourself, how did I get here? It does require some explaining,
to say the least. So computational physics. I don't want to jump too far ahead. The idea of how drones operate and manage to both fly within three-dimensional space as well as do analytics of what's around them, that seems to be like, oh, computational physics
Absolutely.
To drones. But the middle 20
Precisely.
Or so years are a little aberrational. So let's start with The Economist. You were there for 7 years, a writer and editor. Is that right?
I ran various bureaus, but it was mostly writing, as the case for most people at The Economist. I mean, the you're absolutely right. There's a straight line from physics to drones and measuring the world and analyzing it, et cetera. The wiggly in between bits, which consists of about 30 years. Had to do, it's kind of an interesting path. So physics in the late 80s, early 90s, which is when I was there, we were all inspired by the great physicists of the 20th century, the Fermis.
Richard Feynman,
et cetera. And that really was the noble science. Unfortunately, the quest of physics was to get closer and closer to the Big Bang, you know, to understand the origins of the universe. And closer to the Big Bang means higher energies, which means bigger particle accelerators, which means more money. And eventually, we just scaled out of government budgets. And so there were no more particle accelerators in the U.S. that were going to be built. And so you had two choices. You could either like wait in line for, you know, the LHC CERN in Switzerland, wait in line for like 20 years and maybe your experiment would be a success and maybe it wouldn't. Or you could take the skills that you learned in physics and apply them elsewhere. So the skills were, when you think about it, the internet was invented in the physics world to connect labs. The web was invented at CERN, a physics laboratory. And the first big data was physics data, supercomputers using accelerator data. And so you really only had, so most people sort of said, well, what do I got here? I got you know, statistical skills. I can crunch big data. I'll go to Wall Street to be a quant.
Right.
That was the natural one. A lot of people went and did that.
Go for the money.
Some of us said, well, okay, yeah, we can do that. But there's also this internet thing, which just seems kind of interesting. At the time, it was really just a network to connect, you know, scientific laboratories.
Well, the original DARPA concept was, hey, we have to have the capacity to send launch instructions in the event that we're hit first.
Well, sure. But I mean, at the time, this was a little bit past then. The time the internet was largely to connect supercomputer centers for things like climate modeling. You know, this is the part where Al Gore, you know, invented it, which, you know, he actually had a lot. He didn't invent it, but he had a lot to do with encouraging its growth during that era. So those of us, you know, who were sitting there say, well, I don't want to go to Wall Street, but I do have some internet skills. What's the internet good for? Along comes this magazine in 1993 called Wired with like fluorescent ink and saying, hey, this internet thing's going to be big.
One day.
It's not just, you know, a tool to connect labs. It's going to be cultural revolution, et cetera. And so I decided to make my career the internet. And the first step, you know, there was I was working for scientific journals as an editor. And then The Economist asked me to take over their technology beat. And I said, sure, but I'd like to cover the internet. And they're like, well, I don't know, whatever you say, what do you need? And I'm like, I need an internet connection.
This is 92, 93?
This was 93, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And at what point did you end up leaving? So The Economist, you weren't necessarily covering economics and business.
I was originally, and then I went to China to run the bureau there, and was in China from just before the handover of Hong Kong I guess that was 97, to after WTO in 2001. Mm-hmm. Fascinating time to be in China. I got to sort of see modern China emerge. And then was in New York, where you and I spent time together, and then was recruited from there by Condé Nast to run Wired. The only publication I would leave The Economist for.
You were in The Economist New York Bureau, and that's what led to Condé Nast and Wired. So you take over Wired, which was always a good magazine, but it was kind of a hodgepodge for a while.
Well, it basically created this sort of aesthetic and philosophical foundations of the internet's going to be big. It's like the biggest thing since electricity. That was kind of the Wired concept.
Right.
I took over in 2001, so this is after the dot-com bust, and 6 weeks before September 11th.
So excellent timing.
At that point, everyone was dismissing the internet as a fraud, or at least hype.
Or at least wildly overhyped. But that's what I mean by excellent timing.
Absolutely.
You come in with very low expectations. People aren't torturing you to, why don't we have any results this quarter?
Precisely. So I was betting that the internet was real and that the dot-com bust was about Wall Street, not about Silicon Valley. And as you say, when you buy at the bottom, you get three wonderful things. First of all, your failures are cloaked by the marketplace's failures.
Oh, it's just everybody's failing.
You can't
it's
succeed
not
in that in
right.
that in that environment. Secondly, a lot of talent had come to Silicon Valley during the boom, and they were available, so I was able to hire really good people
on the cheap.
They were available. And thirdly, my year on years, I had a really
great
low
comparison.
Baseline. Exactly. The next year, I was just going to blow through my numbers.
So before we move too forward past 2001, having lived through the 90s and all the enthusiasm and all the excitement and then the collapse, how did that color your view of technology and the internet? Or did it?
My faith in technology was completely unshaken. As a physicist, you basically think in terms of what's fundamental in the world. And there's something about the internet that just struck me as fundamental. It struck me as in the same category as democracy and evolution. It's kind of one of these truisms. And as a matter of fact, when I was at The Economist, they had these things called surveys, which are these big 16-page special features. It's the only time you get to use your name as an author.
And which is, by the way, is unique in the world of journalism.
Pretty much unique, exactly.
I mean, where there's no byline. You write an article and it's by The Economist.
The notion of the collective voice, yeah.
Right.
So my first survey on the internet was entitled The Accidental Superhighway. Mm-hmm. And the notion of things happening, by accident suggests that really they're happening by nature. There's this emerged. It was an emergent property
organically
of the universe, exactly. And the fact that it was emergent rather than synthetic meant that it was more real.
Huh. That's quite fascinating. The thing I thought you were heading towards, and I think I'm mangling this, is it Metcalfe's law that does each node multiplies the value? That quickly became obvious that every time you add another user to the internet, the value increased exponentially.
Absolutely. So that's the value element. But the governance structure, the fact that it was not centrally controlled. I mean, there's some trivial central controls.
Well, you have ICANN and you have a whole run of domain issues.
But that's at the very lowest level. But in terms of the content itself, the fact that it is truly democratic, a meritocratic system, that's actually the more important rule. And that's why we've worked so hard to protect the openness of the internet, is because the emergent properties come from that openness.
So one of the questions I wanted to ask you, you kind of answered already, so I want to expand on it. You've been quite astute at forecasting, let's call it near trends, extrapolating from just very nascent things, not well-formed. At this point, I think we all can agree mobile is going to be big one day. But on the other hand, you were looking at things that were – the trend wasn't clear. It wasn't, let's just extrapolate this to infinity. You identified seedlings and said, this is going to be significant. Is it simply the organic nature of it that caught your eye, or how were you able to say, oh, there's huge potential here, and we're just – the people, especially after the crash, people said, it was too good to be true. This is just overhyped. What made you turn around and say, no, this is substantial? Forget the finance part of it. The technology part of it is real.
Yeah. I mean, things like the long tail or drones, which I would do right now. So basically, there's two elements. One of them is that it's just exciting, it's just shiny and exciting, and my heart sings and all that kind of stuff. But that's necessary, but not sufficient. What's sufficient is that it also has to align with my worldview of what works. This sort of notion of openness or emergence or or you know the fact that it benefits from democratization. So my first book, The Long Tail, I mean the or an article as well. I mean the way that happened was not it wasn't an idea. What happened is that I'm sitting here. You know, it's 2001, 2002. I'm a physicist in Silicon Valley, right? I'm now running a magazine. I'm not really trained as a journalist. I'm not, you know, I had a staff full of brilliant narrative storytellers, but I was just kind of a nerd, you know, number cruncher.
Geek so
I was
dad?
Like, indeed. So I needed some numbers to crunch. And I was thinking, you know, I was like, okay, look, I believe that this is the seeds of the 21st century are being formed in the Googles and Amazons and eBays around me. And I'll bet that in those servers is the data that can illustrate what the 21st century looks like. Let's just ask them for the data.
And has anybody previously asked them, hey, we'd like to see your data?
No. Because typically the academics weren't looking at that because that was considered sort of cultural and trivial. Mm-hmm. The companies themselves were just starting to bring up the data scientists and the economists. It was quite early. And journalists just typically weren't quantitative.
Weren't mathy.
Exactly. So there was a brief window if you asked nicely, mm-hmm. and you know, signed some NDAs, et cetera, that you could actually get that data. And so I got the data from places like it was Rhapsody, I think it was Music Services, uh-huh. original one. But I also got sort of scrubbed data from eBay and elsewhere, and just started analyzing it. And the long tail just popped right out of it. It was clearly obvious that there was a kind of a power law distribution, and that the size of the tail, you know, depending on how you split it, was about the size of the head, which suggested that there was a market, a submerged marketplace out there.
Beyond hits, the big sellers.
And what's interesting is that about a year later, after I started, got all this data, then you maybe remember this, AOL, you know, then academics started saying, hey, you know, there's some interesting data here, let's ask for it. AOL released a bunch of data and anonymized it, but didn't anonymize it well enough.
Yeah.
It got de-anonymized. You know, privacy issues, and then it became impossible to get data again. So
right.
There was like a window of about 2 years where you could have done the long tail, and I just happened to be there then.
I was a subscriber. I still am a subscriber to Wired for it's like a decade plus now, and the thing that always stood out to me about Wired was the marriage of great content with a technology slant with fantastic design ethos.
Mm.
The visual impact of the magazine felt like the internet and a print magazine had a baby. It was so visual in ways that other magazines weren't. What was the thinking behind that?
So I can take no credit for that whatsoever. That was the vision of the original founding team, Louis Rossetto, Jane Metcalf, mm-hmm. and John Plunkett, who was the original designer. And their inspiration at the time, the dear friends right now, as a matter of fact, every time there's a new editor, Nick Thompson from The New Yorker is now the editor, mm-hmm. and we all had dinner together. We always kind of, you know, infuse the new editor with the creation myth and all that. But the idea, you know, if you ask them with a story, mm-hmm. They'll say, well, you know, we were this was the emergence of computers, and so print, ink, has got reflective properties,
uh-huh.
but screens have emissive properties.
Sure.
So pixels emit light, and so, you know, we wanted to use an aesthetic that seemed emissive. It glowed
and
on,
a lot
on
of
the page.
A lot of the neon colors and other things very much were like a screen emitting.
Absolutely. So I think that I think they'll forgive me for saying that this is a little bit of a kind of a post facto explanation. I think what really happened at the time is there was a new printing process. I can't know anything about
this. This is
like
cool.
It was a five-color printing process, and it was very expensive. And some printing plants that invested in these new kind of five-color processes were looking for some examples to show them off. And it just basically that like a fancy ink, and like fluorescent mm-hmm. ink, became available affordably, and so they took advantage of it.
It makes perfect sense. And the magazine always popped. You turn the pages, and it really was alive. So you take over Wired with the air coming out of the bubble. It was mm-hmm. mid-collapse.
And it would get worse.
And got worse. How hard was it to stay positive as things just went down the tubes?
For me, it was super easy. I would say that I think you're going to be talking to Mark Andreessen as well. You know, those of us who were there then never never doubted that the internet was real. We mm-hmm. understood the distinction between the stock market valuations and the underlying technology.
What was the West Coast view? Oh, the guys in New York really messed this up. You know, they took valuations too high. No surprise Icarus crashed into the sea.
I was actually in China during the bubble, mm-hmm. During the dot-com bubble, so I can't really say what the collective view was. But I do think that, you know, the underlying belief that there was something fundamental going on here with mm-hmm. the networks was never doubted. Now, there's, of course, you know how the internet works. Like, there's the layers, right? There's like the hardware layer with the fiber optic cables, mm-hmm. and then there's like, you know, then the software layers and content layers. A lot of the valuations were at the higher level of the content. And mm-hmm. the notion was the content was ephemeral. It would come and go. But the underlying notion of connecting the world was really important. And so, you know, I think when I got there, the consensus was that Wall Street had financed an extraordinary infrastructure build-out, which made fiber capacity super cheap. And this was the best thing ever for restarting. That suddenly the cost of the cost of entry was very low. Thank you, Wall Street. And that we would just now, you know, build for the next 2 years without, you know, the financial microscope and see where it goes.
Dan Gross wrote a book called Pop: Why Bubbles Are Better Than People Realize, and the example he used, whether it's railroads or telegrams or in this case dark fiber, Global Crossing and Metro Media Fiber, and go down the list. They laid miles and miles of dark fiber at thousands of dollars per whatever it was, and it sells for pennies on the dollar. The theory is, but for this collapsing, you don't end up with YouTube and Facebook
exactly.
and all these other bandwidth intensive things.
Yeah, no, Dan's super smart, and the book's great. I think when you look back now at that decade, it's almost impossible to see the bust. When you look at the underlying adoption curves and data curves, et cetera, it's weird. I mean, you can obviously see it on
in
NASDAQ.
In the 90s or in the—
No, if you look back today, if you look back at internet adoption trends, mm-hmm. you almost can't see the dip.
Right, because the end customers continued to be added at a tremendous rate.
Because there was something real there. People mm-hmm. wanted what we were making, and the fact that it was cheaper only accelerated the adoption.
So let's talk about Wired. When you take over Wired, it's kind of a hodgepodge. I think at one point they didn't even own their own domain. Mm-hmm. So if you wanted to do internet stuff, how did that come about?
Again, before my time, but Wired was, you know, sort of before the dot-com bubble, there were previous bubbles, mm-hmm. and Wired was the hottest thing around in the late 90s. Basically created a lot of online media. So like Apache, the web servers used, mm-hmm. was actually created, in the Wired offices. The first banner ad was on Wired. You know, a lot of the things we take for granted today were actually being pioneered in the laboratories that mm-hmm. were Wired. They filed to go public.
Wired as a standalone company.
Wired as a standalone company.
What year is this?
Oh, again, way
early
before my time. I'm going to say 97-ish.
Okay.
Maybe 98, didn't work, filed again, didn't work, had taken out some finance, some debt on anticipation that it would go public, and ended up having to kind of fire sale some of the bits. And the magazine, the print bit, went to Condé Nast, and the digital bit went to Lycos, which was a search engine, which then got bought by some Korean mm-hmm. media company. Anyway, it was like one of those, like, you know, the children got adopted by different families kind of deal.
And you helped bring them both under the same roof.
I didn't. All credit goes to Condé Nast. It was clearly it needed to be done. And just, mm-hmm. you know, years went by and valuations kind of stabilized and Condé Nast appropriately brought it back.
So you really turned the entire magazine around and turned it into this award-winning affair.
I actually it was very much award-winning before I got there.
Not magazine of the decade, not editor of the year. Those are pretty substantial awards in the industry.
I think what we did is we believed in the underlying story. The reason I left The Economist, which is the best gig ever, by the way, mm-hmm. was that Wired had changed my life. That I'm as a physicist sitting there nerding away on these mm-hmm. networks, you know, not believing they were any more than physics. Wired opened my eyes to the potential technology to change the world. I know it's a very kind of cliched to say mm-hmm. that, but that's what it did. And so when I had the opportunity to run Wired, I said, well, this is the biggest story of my lifetime. The ability to be there in the middle of Silicon Valley and tell this story is, that story's not done. And all I did is just kept the faith.
So you're running the magazine, you're the editor-in-chief, you're overseeing publication, and you're writing both articles and books. How do you juggle any one of those things or a full-time job? How do you juggle all of that at once? And you, by the way, you're married and have five kids.
And I'm married and have five kids and a lot of hobbies because I ended up starting a drone company on
Maker
the side
Dad
as well.
Maker Dad and then DIY Dad drones. You had a lot of balls in the air, to say the least.
I did. I think I was, I had a good staff. And, my general philosophy on leading teams is to kind of point them in a direction, set some guidelines of what success looks
measurable
like.
Targets
measurable
and say
targets
go
and let them do their job. One of the things that Wired as a bully pulpit, I guess, for the mm-hmm. technology stories, one of the things that that the editors can do is to be a public persona and to do their own writing because unlike most media, which is American media, which is required to be impartial and dispassionate and not take a point of view, The Economist and Wired shared one thing, which is that they do have a point of view. They have mm-hmm. a worldview. The Economist one famously is British liberalism, mm-hmm. which is free markets and free people. Wired basically took the same approach but then had this evangelism for technology. So the notion of being evangelical, of being a preacher, which meant also being a doer, was kind of core to the Wired credo. And so the reason I did all these side things and did the research that led to the long tail and free and makers was that was the hands-on. That was the doing. I mean, that's what Silicon Valley is all about. It's about doers. And I just didn't feel I could tell the story if I wasn't doing it.
That's quite fascinating. You mentioned the free and the freemium model. That was pretty prescient when you put that out. What do you think of the freemium model today? Is it still working, and how has it negatively impacted other industries like print journalism?
Yeah, no, exactly. Just to be clear, I've written three books. They're all basically the same book. So the long tail.
Hold on a second. So the long tail, that's a very specific book that an eBay or an Amazon or any online retailer, Netflix, has the ability to have essentially an infinite warehouse versus a brick and mortar. Sears, which is circling the drain, cannot have every, or Barnes & Noble for that matter, they can't have every single book Absolutely. Available in the store. That's a very different argument than, all right, give this stuff away for free, and some percentage of those users will pay you a small fee for a higher level of whatever it is.
You've articulated the thesis of those very well, but let me suggest that they're more connected than you may suggest.
Okay,
so if infinite shelf space creates infinite choice, mm-hmm. and therefore we can measure people's actual likes and dislikes in a world of infinite choice, then how do you get infinite shelf space? Well, the only way you can get infinite shelf space is the cost of shelf space. The marginal cost is zero.
Or certainly as close to zero
close to zero. So what are the economics of zero-cost markets? Mm-hmm. These are markets where essentially free is an attainable price. Mm-hmm. What are the economics of free? Well, there weren't any. Economics by definition is monetary economics. Non-monetary economics are something else, psychology, sociology.
Sociology, right.
Sociology, exactly. So, but what if you applied economic principles to try to create an economic framework for free, to treat it the same way you would treat monetary markets? Then you could explain not only how things could be free, but how maybe you would use free as the way as a form of marketing. That you would basically give things away for free, and that unlike a traditional market where you can give out, you can get free tastes of brownies, but not many
but
of them.
But a finite amount, with a fixed cost for each
exactly.
of them.
Exactly. So in worlds where you have non-zero marginal costs, you can give away 1% and you must sell 99. Where you have near zero marginal costs, you can give away 99% to sell one. And just that notion that there was an underlying economic model behind the long tail that drove the long tail led me to free. So freemium, you're correct, is the business model around it. And when I wrote it, freemium was kind of starting to be known in kind of business-to-business mm-hmm. software, et cetera. It was just before the App Store on and mobile. You could start to see the beginnings of it. It was mostly in web games that you were seeing freemium as a model.
But this is an example of you identifying something when it was just germinating and saying, oh, this is going to be big one day. It was most people have one of those in their lifetime if they're lucky. here it is, not long after the long tail, and here's the next big thing, and you were dead right about it.
I have to admit that I didn't do anything. I mean, it was happening around me. Mm-hmm. There was a bazillion great entrepreneurs. Fred Wilson from Union Square Ventures,
sure.
I think it was the person who deserves the most credit for popularizing freemium. But all I did
is— Did he gave it the name, or did he just popularize it?
One of his entrepreneurs, I think, coined the term, but Fred—
Freemium.
Freemium, mm-hmm. which is the combination of free and premium.
Right. So you give all this away for free,
and if you
want to upgrade—
Exactly.
Right. And then you can actually measure the metrics. Here's our user research. Here's how many people open it. Here's how many people engage, log in, sign up, and here's how many of those convert to the paying model.
In-app purchases being the perfect mm-hmm. example. So today, freemium is the canonical business model of online, of mobile apps, which is to say most apps are free, especially mm-hmm. games, et cetera. And there's all these in-app purchases that encourage
right.
some people to pay.
Upgrade, you get secret levels or more weapons or whatever it happens.
So again, I didn't coin anything. I didn't invent anything. What I saw, though, is that there was a smart people were starting to act in a certain way, and I just created a framework for it.
All right, so let's go from long tail to free to makers,
right?
Which, again, I'm going to argue is a totally different—
Same book. Same book. It's the long tail physical goods.
Right, so you have the ability to put— So when I was a kid, and we're not that far apart in age, I was a kid, you could have these little scientific— What was it called, the company that put out
Edmund
these—
Edmund Scientific?
Yeah, you would either get a chemistry set or there were a variety of electronic set.
Mm.
I remember the electronic
Radio
set.
Radio Shack.
Right, and you could put together, you can combine these things in different ways. Oh, look, I could make a little a home radio kit just by combining these different things.
But you didn't go much beyond that.
Right. You point out that, hey, the cost of these things, including little electric engines that you could order from China for next to nothing— Here's what you could do today, and it's nothing like it was back then.
So the fundamental difference there was not just the cost of the goods, because they were already pretty cheap. It's just that when you and I were tinkering in our bedrooms or workshops or basements, et cetera, we were essentially all doing the same thing.
Right.
We were all doing the same kits, but weren't doing anything new, innovative. We weren't building on other people's work because we didn't have an internet back then. So we had a book, and we followed the instructions of the book. But that was it. We weren't doing anything innovative. So what was new about the maker movement, and 2007 was the key year in the maker movement, a bunch of things happened that year. First of all, and all those things were standing on the shoulders of the web and communities and open source, mm-hmm. et cetera. But you had things like Arduino, which was an open source computing board that allowed you to use your coding skills but actually move things in the physical world. Mm-hmm. There was 3D printing that allowed you to fabricate things you couldn't do on your own. There was you started to see these sensors that you would things in like a Wii controller, and in my case it was Lego Mindstorms, that you allowed you to measure the real world with these extraordinary little chips that could measure things. There was Make Magazine. There was the Maker Faire.
Mm-hmm.
And behind it all, that was the year the iPhone was released. And it wasn't clear initially that the iPhone had a connection to this. But when we said, why is it that, so I started with my kids. We made a drone on the dining room table out of Lego parts.
Mm-hmm.
Fully autonomous, GPS guided, and this is like, a few years earlier, that was like military, industrial,
right.
classified, export control stuff. And we did it
right.
with Legos. Cars. We did it with Legos, Lego Mindstorms. It's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
Only later did I say, how is it possible that we were able to do this? I mean, I can see you've got a Fitbit or something on
uh-huh.
your arm. I've got a Pebble.
They're terribly inaccurate. They make me feel good because I do 20,000 steps apparently every day.
I see. Well, there's a little green LED that's just flashing like crazy underneath there.
That's because it tries to measure my heart rate and it's unable to keep up.
Okay. Maybe not the best example. But the
technology in this is astonishing. Go back in time and this is...
I was sitting there in 2007 with my kids and Lego Mindstorms. A guy named James Park had just gotten a Wii controller,
mm-hmm.
A Wii, video game,
sure.
and the controller, and he's like, what is this? What's in this stick that lets that cursor move on the screen?
The three-dimensional
exactly.
accelerometer and
he
everything
opens it
else
up, there's a little
it.
Chip in there, and he says, awesome, what else would that chip be good for? And he comes up with Fitbit with his colleagues. So what happened is that a series of core technologies, what's called MEMS sensors, these sensors on a chip,
Micro electromechanical
sensors in this, like a sense of
system. So they can sense motion, direction, gravity, everything else.
These you know, these incredibly fast low power processors, the ARM, Wi-Fi, cameras, GPS, lithium battery technologies, all this stuff was coming out of the iPhone and other smartphones. And because you had these extraordinary kind of, you know, amount of R&D and economies of scale and production, those components were now available to adjacent industries. And, you know,
very inexpensive.
Very inexpensive. And I call this the peace dividend of the smartphone
wars. Sure.
What happened is that you take these extraordinary technologies, these chips that are now available really, you know, inexpensively. Then you have these desktop fabrication tools like 3D printers and CNC machines and laser cutters, et cetera. And then you have open source communities. You combine them, and now you've got the germs of an industrial revolution. And this ability for regular people to make the long tail of physical things mm-hmm. rather than just digital things is what drove the maker movement and the Kickstarter phenomenon and what we're experiencing today. So yeah, so I started by just sort of like, you know, just on weekends throwing together kits, and you know, the problem is that they sold out immediately and the kids just wouldn't do it again. So
right.
I'm like, I got better things to do than stuff pizza boxes. So I found a guy on the internet named Jordi Munoz who seemed really smart, and I sent him a check for $500 and he just started doing it instead.
Mm-hmm.
And then he kept sending me pictures, and he's like, yeah, I've expanded the space. I haven't met him, right? I've expanded the space, got hired some people. And by 2012...
He's in Mexico, is that right?
Oh, I didn't know.
Oh.
It turns out that he was, you know, when I met him, he was a 19-year-old in Tijuana, just graduated mm-hmm. from high school. But by, you know, by the time I actually went, it's like, he kept sending me these pictures of bigger and bigger drone factories. By the time I met him, I mean, we were probably doing $5 million a year. By around 2012, I think we were making more drones per month than all of America's aerospace companies combined.
Wow.
Out of a Tijuana drone factory, which, by the way, is a great name for a band.
Tijuana drone factory. That's it. Absolutely.
And so by the time I actually made it like not a hobby, but like my job, and took venture capital, et cetera, is already pretty de-risked. And so yeah, we at this point we were making physical drones. But we started. I'll just finish with one last story about this. In around 2009 or 10 or 12 or something like that, there's the aerospace industry has an annual conference. It's called AUVSI. Autonomous Vehicles Systems International, something mm-hmm. like that. Anyway, it's like, you know, the Boeings and the Lockheeds. And
right. They have Predator drones that are
precisely.
40 feet long.
And it's happening actually this week, I think, in Las Vegas is the annual one. Anyway, one of the more, you know, innovative guys on the board invited me to speak to, like, you know, the military-industrial complex. And I spoke, and I held up this little board that we were making called ArduPilot, which is based on Arduino, and it cost $24.95. And I said, so we can do, you know, at this point, drones cost $10 million
right.
and up. And I come out with this board that's $24.95. And I said, if you take this board and you stick it in, like, a toy airplane, you basically got the same thing you guys do.
Right, just for $10 million less.
Yeah, and they just couldn't figure – I mean, they couldn't decide whether I was, you know, whether I was crazy or dangerous or both.
Right.
But they knew that it wasn't – that it was a joke. You know, they knew that I was not to be taken seriously. And, you know, the Gandhi phrase, they first they ignore you, then
right.
they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you've won. Today, you know, that board and others like it, there are other people who are doing the same thing at the same time. There are now a million drones sold per year. You can now – there's never been a technology I can think of that went from military-industrial complex to the toy shelves of Walmart faster mm-hmm. than drones. And when we started, people said, you can't use the word drone because it sounds like a weapon. Now they tell us we can't use the word drone because it sounds like a toy.
So the question – all right, so I have to ask. The question I asked when I saw that – big black drone out outside of your reception area is, all right, so where's the hunter-killer adaptation? How do I add something to, if I need to take care of business, what's the adaptation to? It's got elements of Skynet to it. How often do you get that idiotic question? Because some of these
It's not that idiotic. ISIS is using drones very much like ours, hopefully mm-hmm. not ours, but very much like ours today. They did exactly what you described. They'll buy drones from China.
Mm-hmm.
They stick a little hook on the bottom, and then they drop bombs
off of the drones.
From the drones.
So there was another drone I was looking at last weekend in the Apple store. That it's very light. It's very small. The rotors are encaged in a sort of
the hover drone.
And it has this facial recognition software built in. So when you lock it on somebody, it just tracks them. And I'm like, oh, that's how you assassinate people. You just need some minor thing. That far from Skynet.
Yeah, I can be pretty, you know, whatever the science fiction catastrophe you imagine, you know, there may be catastrophe, but it won't be that catastrophe.
Oh, I don't think it's a broad catastrophe. I think it's just an efficient way to remove certain people who are problematic.
Well,
how far away is that from
so that
Tuesday?
That particular one. So that's not going to happen for a number of reasons. First of all, if you'd actually taken it out of the box and turned it on, you would have heard that it's really noisy. Mm. And you're not going to let this, like, buzzing, you know, mini lawnmower.
By the time you hear it, it's too – that's their tagline. By the time you hear us coming, it's too late.
Would that were true. You heard drones this morning. They're noisy. You're not going to stealth, you know, now, at least not with a helicopter.
How far away are we from stealthier rotors? Or is that just physics and that's never going to change?
Well, you know, we work hard on that. You know, we don't make the drones anymore. We just do the software. But, you know, up against – so we could absolutely do more with, you know, sort of different propeller designs and, you know, vibrations and resonant frequencies and all speeds and all this kind of stuff. But by and large, you're up against physics. Now, that's not to say that an airplane, you know, the ones with wings can't just glide their way silently. Mm-hmm. But it's not going to hover. So you get hover and noise or you get non-hover and
so
silent.
Either stealthy or very mobile. So you mentioned earlier you realize this is a real business. You said let's most of this is de-risked. Let's go to the venture capital route. What was that process? You had VC money from Qualcomm, from Richard Branson, from True Ventures. What is the process like going to a VC and saying, hey, we have this idea for a new company where we're going to build and sell this new technology?
Well, at this point, it wasn't a new company. Remember, we'd bootstrapped it to something like $5 million of revenues, and I was making money, and you know, so that's quite unusual to de-risk something that much. So taking it to venture capitalists, I mean, it's very early. And at this point, we were roughly, basically technology. We were sort of saying, you know, we have autopilots, which are these boxes, the brains for the planes, et cetera. We have autopilots. You know, we have some kits. It was by no means the shelves of Walmart yet.
Right.
And we actually articulated the ultimate goal not being selling consumer electronic devices in Walmart, but rather putting sensors in the sky. The intention was always to use drones as a tool. To extend the internet into physical space. And so, you know, part of extending the internet into physical space is to gather, to sense the space and the cameras, et cetera. The other is to extend the intelligence of the internet out so the devices can basically harness the collective, you know, whatever, the big data, neural networks, whatever. So the idea was, okay, we're going to put sensors in the sky. It's going to complement ground sensors. It's going to complement satellites. If you look up, the sky is empty. It is just the weirdest thing. I mean, it's very hard to find a market as empty as the sky.
But there's a lot of sky out there.
There's
room for plenty of drones, and it doesn't look like you're really taking up a lot of space.
Exactly. And the drones are smart. In the same way, you know, the analogy I would use is on wireless. You know, there was a time when the FCC's job was to give wireless carriers monopoly ownership of certain waves, certain spectrum. You know, this frequency is yours and that frequency is somebody else's. And we have to kind of, you know, block off the bits so they don't interfere and ruin, you know, grandma's television reception or whatever it was in those days. Then along came Wi-Fi, which says, hey, you know what? If we have, like, low power and the ability to kind of listen before you talk and, you know, digital radios, et cetera, maybe you could just give us a sandbox, a little sort of, you know, spectrum, just let us, you know,
play.
No licenses, no ham radio, just, you know, no monopolies, just let us play. And that's essentially what we achieved with drones. We said, hey, you know, give us a sandbox. That sandbox is going to be visual line of sight, under 400 feet, don't fly over people, private land, and things like that. And originally it was recreational use, not commercial use. And all those things were legal. You know, call them loopholes or call them, you know, let's say.
It was a carve-out.
I think it was a carve-out actually for radio control hobbyists rather than for drones. It happened in the 70s.
Right.
But we used that carve-out to basically stick a million drones in the air. And then we're like, okay, now they're here. They're good. Now, what are they good for? And this became the commercial use. And originally, I thought it was going to be agriculture. I thought we were going to be, you know,
They are currently used pretty robustly in
they are, but not as much
agriculture, real estate. I can't tell you how many homes I've seen that standard drone, pan over. Oh, isn't that lovely? Look at that. I mean, that's become standard.
So Hollywood, of course, is was
huge.
The first one. So
now you guys were involved with Fast and Furious. If I've seen some of your toys around.
No, actually, we were involved in the Benghazi film. But the Fast and Furious is we have these sprints. And, so sprints are development milestones are all named after Fast and Furious films. Fast and Furious, exactly. Mm-hmm. And it just turns out they're making the films about as quickly as we can develop. So,
I think this is towards the end of them at this point, this last one.
You think number 8 is going to be the end?
I'm hoping.
Well, we'll have to come up with another theme for our sprints.
So what have you done much in with Hollywood? Have you done much on that side?
So we did a tiny bit in Hollywood, but actually there's back when we were making drones, our biggest competitor was a Chinese company called DJI, which was extraordinary, perhaps the best company I've ever seen anywhere, not just in China. And they really focused on the cameras and the stabilization, et cetera. And today,
DJI makes the Parrot.
No, Parrot is a French company. DJI makes the Phantom.
Oh, the Phantom, okay.
And, it's something called the Mavic and others.
I remember when the Phantom first came out, it was like $2,000, then it was $1,200, then it was $700. The prices just plummeted in that. Is that China subsidizing this, or are these guys really wringing out economies of scale like that?
It's that good. Yeah. I lived in China. I knew, when I lived in China for those years at The Economist, everyone said, oh, don't worry about China. They can't do X. X was like innovate or design or software or global brands or anything like that.
There's a very subtle racism built into that. Which is a repeat of what I recall hearing about Japan.
Yeah.
Right?
Remember, or Korea.
Japan early on was, they only make junk. They're good at imitating. They can't innovate anything. And then suddenly, wow, this is really first-class products. And if you remember when Hyundai first came out, they were kind of junky cars. Yeah. And now suddenly they were the only company that comes out of the financial crisis increasing market share. I think it was them and Subaru. So that, those guys can't do anything. That's a very dangerous assumption for anyone to ever make.
Everything I learned about China before going there, I think turned out to be wrong. Everyone said, the political system is unsustainable, their economic growth is unsustainable, this quote-unquote centrifugal forces would sort of splinter.
Throw them apart, yeah.
They can't innovate, they only copy. And it was around 2008 or 2009 where I spent most of my time in Guangdong province, around Shenzhen. And I spent a night in Huawei, which is the telecoms company.
Sure.
At the time, they were being accused of
stealing
from the Cisco stuff. It was way before iPhone. Mm-hmm. So this is 97, 98. I spent a night, the engineers were working all night, sleeping on futons. And I was like, these guys are awesome.
They're serious.
They're serious. They're basically, yes, they're making iPhones today, but they're taking notes.
Mm-hmm.
And the company we ended up competing with, DJI, started around actually a little bit before us. The so-called China can't do X, we haven't found an X.
Really?
So they innovated. They raised $10 billion, billions of dollars of venture capital, at a $10 billion valuation.
Wow.
They went global initially. They actually targeted outside of China before China. Their design exquisite. Their marketing is fantastic. Then their production efficiencies, because they were in Shenzhen, they vertically integrated, so they're doing everything. They weren't just buying off the shelf stuff like we were.
They're making it all themselves from scratch.
Fundamental physics, design, et cetera. So, watching them, I knew that these 21st century Chinese companies were coming. I knew that they were going to be good. But just watching the price decline that came with that.
Shocking.
70% price decline in 9 months.
Wow.
I think there's a, we were.
As the quality went up, the price was freefall.
Exactly. And I don't think they were dumping. I think they're just that good.
Wow.
So we were one of the first Silicon Valley companies to encounter a 21st century native Chinese company.
Mm-hmm.
And we won't be the last.
So let's talk about the pivot. You originally were designing and manufacturing drones and doing all the software that went into it. The concept is, hey, we don't even want to try and compete with this behemoth on manufacturing. But the software, sort of an Apple model of, hey, we'll let these guys build the hardware. We're going to build the brains of it because that's where our expertise is. How did that pivot come about, and how is that going?
Yeah, so we did it all. We did the hardware, we did the software, which is like the operating system for the drone, and we also did the apps that ran with it. We ended up breaking them into three parts. The hardware part we just spun off and don't do that at all anymore. So we now support mm-hmm. whatever hardware is out there.
So if I want to go out and buy a 3DR drone, are they still available for sale?
They are. It's called SightScan. It's our commercial one. It's actually mm-hmm. It is a drone that we did make. But the
Solo or the
it's a derivative of the Solo, but it's got mm-hmm. a fancy Sony camera and some mm-hmm. fancy GPS, etc.
Nice gimbal attached to it as well.
Exactly. But soon enough, if you want a different kind of drone, we'll support that as well. So we're trying to be hardware agnostic. Right now, mm-hmm. we think that this particular integration with the Sony camera is, the best camera, and that's the way to go. But I think that over time we're going to be more flexible, mm-hmm. and if people want, a different drone, that'll be fine. I think that's almost all American drone companies have done the same thing. Everyone stopped making their own hardware. Most mm-hmm. people are supporting DJI at this point. Then there was the operating system part, and that was mostly open source. Mm-hmm. Thanks to the way we started. And so we spun that off, and that's now part of the Linux Foundation. It's called Drone Code. And so I'm the chairman of that as well.
Oh, that's interesting. So that's open source, available to anyone who wants to use it or improve it.
Exactly. So that's Drone Code. And then there's the apps. And the apps is where we focus. This is mm-hmm. using the drone data. So it's less about the drone, more about the data. Using the drone data to do something useful. And in our case, we partnered with Autodesk, who's the dominant company in the
3D design.
It's AutoCAD, and mm-hmm. it's construction and engineering and architecture and things like that. And they, their initiative has been to sort of say, in construction, you start everything digital on screen in CAD, mm-hmm. and then the moment you dig a spade of dirt, it's now analog, mm-hmm. and you can't measure it, you can't use the same tools. So what you need to do is re-digitize the world as you're building it, and that's called reality capture, and we're the capture in reality capture.
So that's interesting. I've been watching somebody putting up, it's got to be for the past, 2 years, every month or every 2 months, the drone flyover of the Apple campus, and yeah. I've watched this come together. It certainly is time compressed. It feels like, they've been working on that a long time. It seems like it's only a year or so mm-hmm. I've been watching this, but it's astonishing at the clarity and focus and amount of details that you can see for what is essentially private property. Yeah we're gonna go in and what sort of issues do you have when you're trying to get that granular on a construction site, and are there problems with people sending drones? So the first question is really, how granular can you get on a construction site in identifying how big is this hole, how deep is this foundation, how much sand is this here? And then I'll save the question about people doing flyovers for later.
Yeah, and the answer to the first is 2 centimeters per pixel.
2 centimeters per pixel.
Yeah, so basically we can see a quarter.
Okay. That's pretty detailed.
It's pretty detailed. So what you described as photographs, maybe video, that's actually not what the construction industry wants.
You're talking about actually the measurements of everything contained therein.
So the process is, and you probably saw it this morning on our roof, the process is you take out an iPad. There's a drone just sitting there. Mm-hmm. You turn on the drone, press the button, take out your iPad. You either you're doing the same scan every day, in which case you just swipe. Mm-hmm. Or you just drag a box around the thing you want to scan, and then you swipe. The drone then takes off. It flies like a lawnmower pattern or a crosshatch pattern and takes photographs at exactly the right time so those photographs can be stitched together into a 3D model or a 2D model. And then then you superimpose the CAD file, which, the underlying design, over this model, and you can compare as designed with as built.
So this is a little bit of augmented reality?
Yeah,
you're,
exactly.
You're essentially putting it's almost like a wire map on top of the world and comparing it to what was supposed to be built.
Precisely. And because it's all so precise, if something's off, it's actually off. So if a post is off or a trench is off or one of the cables this is called post tensioning cables, which is a big thing mm-hmm. in construction, you can actually see it's called a clash. And when you see that the physical the physical site is off from the design, there's only two possibilities. Either it was an intentional change for good reason.
Right.
And in which case you need to reflect that change back into the model so that everyone understands that things have changed. Or it was an accident, in which case you need to catch it and fix it.
And it sounds like it's vastly less expensive to catch it early than to catch it after the building is built. And hey, why are we tilting in San Francisco? There's
exactly.
that famous building that's off. You guys would have caught that earlier, whatever was...
I don't know if we would have caught that one, but the construction industry is the second largest industry in the world.
That's amazing. After
food, $8 trillion industry. And unlike agriculture, which is hedged against all sorts of inefficiencies, water, mm-hmm. et cetera, construction's not. It's got 80% average cost overruns.
80%? That's
cost
amazing.
So it's like a $5 trillion industry that overran itself to $8 trillion. And those cost overruns are typically due to just... You know, stuff happened, right? Mm-hmm. Mistakes, delays. It's a complicated supply chain. Any kind of delay turns into cost.
This is a huge efficiency creator, huge cost savings. Is the expectation eventually every major contractor is using some form of drones to help build what they're doing?
No, so there's lots of ways to do reality capture. You can do it on the ground with laser scanning. You can do it on the ground with cameras. There's inside the building and outside the building. So what drone scanning is best for is commercial construction,
mm-hmm.
typically some of the larger sites. Often not like in a city center because you have FAA regulations about where you can fly and where you can't fly. So it's kind of commercial sites like skyscrapers, mm-hmm. you know, big complexes, typically outside of a city center. But still, you're talking about maybe a third of construction falls into that category. And then the most important time to do it is at the beginning when you've got the site, you're digging the holes and the foundations, mm-hmm. et cetera, that characterizing it. Because remember, the drone's just scanning the outside of the building. So you scan the site, you scan the foundations, and then you scan each layer as they build it up.
So given the snafu with that Leaning Tower of San Francisco, how unlikely is it that eventually cine planners are going to say, hey, if we want to avoid this, we have to allow some sort of external
Absolutely.
Scanning.
It's being required right now. It's part of a so Japan has just required drone scannings by 2020 for all
in major cities.
Yeah, well, it's for government infrastructure. They do a lot of roads and bridges mm-hmm. and highways and things like that. This is part of a trend called building information modeling, BIM. And
building information modeling.
It's basically the notion of digitizing sites. So you mm-hmm. can manage, you know, you can only manage what you can measure.
Mm-hmm.
And governments are now requiring BIM, which is to say, hey, you know, we need you to measure these sites because these cost overruns are being paid for by somebody.
Right. And ultimately it's the consumer, the end user, who's going to subsidize that, unless it's a government project, in which case it's a taxpayer.
It's a reasonable request. Measure what you're doing so that we can manage it better. You know, either we're going to avoid the errors, or if it happens, we know why it happened, who caused it, you know, paper trail. I mean, so many construction projects end in lawsuits.
Mm-hmm.
And you have this question, like, how did that happen?
We were discussing earlier about the low cost of all these chipsets and individual chips that allowed you to do really incredible things at a very low cost. What made you realize that, hey, these drone things, this is more than just a cool little toy?
First of all, I didn't initially realize that.
Okay.
My path was really simple. I've got 5 kids. My wife and I are former scientists. We try to get our kids excited about science and technology, and we fail and fail and fail again. And so every weekend, I'm trying to think of something that'll engage them.
Keep them busy.
Well, I mean, keep them busy. I mean, video games will keep them busy, but I want to keep their minds busy as well. So one weekend, I'm editor of Wired, you know, and we get these like products in for review. And this Lego Mindstorms NXT robotics mm-hmm. kit comes in, and this like radio control airplane comes in. And I'm like, okay, one of these two things is going to work. Either the robot. You know, building robot will be cool, or
right.
at least flying a plane will be cool. And, you know, the kids roll their eyes and, oh, another one of Dad's things. So we built the robot, and it was not cool.
It was not cool.
I thought it was cool. But, you know, it's basically you spend all morning building it out of Lego pieces, and it rolls very slowly against
waves
the wall.
Waves its arms.
And
it doesn't,
oh, right, if only it waved its arms. Basically just had 2 wheels, and it rolled towards a wall and then kind of backed away. And they're like, come on, we've seen Transformers.
Right.
You know, where are the lasers? And then, you know, the next—
Where are the lasers?
And then on the next day, we flew the airplane, which is to say I flew it directly into a tree. And then
right.
That sucked. so my thought process consisted of the following. You know, one, those rotten kids.
Right.
You know, two, that actually wasn't very cool. 3, what would have been cooler? Huh, what if the robot could fly the plane?
What if we had a flying robot? That'd be cool. What's a flying robot?
I just came home, Googled flying robot. If you Google flying robot, you will find the first result is drone.
Uh-huh.
And you're like, oh, huh, I guess a drone is a flying robot. Wait, what's a drone? Google drone. Oh, a drone is like an airplane with an autopilot. It's like a plane with a brain.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, I guess that makes sense. Wait, what's an autopilot? Google autopilot. Oh, an autopilot is like sensors and software that, you know, kind of measure, you know, the orientation of the plane and fly it. It's like, oh, wait, sensors and software. Isn't that what's in the Lego Mindstorms box?
Right.
Let's just do that. And so there on the dining room table, we put together a Lego autopilot and we stuck it in the RC plane, which I had retrieved from the tree, and took it back to the field. And it, you know, it worked just well enough, as in kind of flew autonomously, just long enough for me to say, holy cow, what have we just done here? The kids are like, yeah, as we said, that sucked, Dad. you know, and I'm like, wait.
So they're at Kitty Hawk watching the invention of drones, and they're like, yeah, what else you got?
Yeah, exactly. You flew for like 60 feet. Come on. You know, where's my jetpack?
I have that T-shirt somewhere. Where's my flying car?
So the hairs went up on the back of my neck. I was like, I don't know what just happened there, but I need to find out. And so I created a website called DIY Drones, which was basically a place for me to ask dumb questions in public. And when you ask dumb questions in public, two wonderful things happen. Number one, people answer your dumb questions. And second, it liberates other people to ask their own dumb questions. Mm-hmm. And it was just that moment. It's 2007. It's the moment where all these disciplines were coming together. There were software people and hardware people and airplane people, et cetera. And over the course of a couple of years, the community basically created the most advanced drones, you know, certainly the most advanced drones you could buy. I'm possibly the most advanced drones in the world, at least the technology, and it was our job just to create a company to turn them into a product.
So originally, you were selling kits. You could get these engines, you could get these motors, these battery packs, and here, put this together yourself and have some fun. When did that, first of all, how long did that go on and how did that come about? And then when did that transfer to let's build drones and sell it to the public?
So it was a hobby from 2007 to 2013.
Oh, so a full 6 years of just...
Me just noodling away. Now, when I say hobby, it started with me and my kids putting together robot blimp kits in pizza boxes.
Did they ever get excited about the idea of drones?
No.
Never?
Never.
And you
never.
Have some crazy cool stuff here. Even this stuff, they're like, who cares?
Yeah.
No.
I know. You know. You got any more kids?
I brought one, and he's walking around, eyes bugging out of his head, going, oh, my God, look at all this stuff. But he's in his 30s, so he's easily right. He's the right age. I think they're spoiled.
It's a dad thing.
Let's talk about Silicon Valley and the so-called bubble and unicorns. I always hate when people pull out the most extreme example of something and try and paint everybody with that broad brush. Is there a bubble in Silicon Valley today?
I'm the worst person to ask.
Okay.
So I actually have paid no attention to valuations.
Really?
It's not how we keep score.
Doesn't it affect the ability to either find talent, hire, source things? When things get crazy, it's like, hey, we can't hire anybody. These engineers are asking for $400,000 as a base salary. When things get really out of hand, doesn't it affect everything?
It must. I mean, I'm sure you're right. I mean, the engineers that I've worked with in the past are motivated primarily by the work.
Mm-hmm.
They want to do the most exciting work of their career. I mean, there was a while when our recruiting technique consisted of the words flying robot.
Right. That was it.
Any questions?
Where do I sign?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm sure that at some level, the ability to, you know, have upside in your stock options or salary. I mean, of course, that's a thing. But it should be a second order thing. I mean, the reason that, you know, the Teslas and Ubers are able to, Uber's a special case, let's not say the Teslas of the world or Apples are able to hire so well, is because you're going to do really exciting, meaningful work.
Mm-hmm. On the way up here, we passed the Tesla factory, and it's enormous. And it's just like, wait, what was there before this was, oh, that was just a field.
No, it was actually, no, it's a great story. It's a really good This American Life episode. Uh-huh. It was Numi, the GM Toyota, I think, experiment
sure.
in the future of car manufacturing.
Well, it turns out to so be well. Right. Turns out there that's the future of, could be the future of cars.
You know,
right
people
there.
Don't give Elon enough credit for that particular one. He was able to buy that factory. It's a mile long.
Right.
He was
it's
able
huge.
To buy that factory for, you know, for pennies on the dollar. Mm-hmm. Before there was any real case, and originally Tesla was like a tiny corner, like 1/10 of the factory at the end. And by the end, by the time he's done, he'll be using it all of it and more.
And then some.
And he bought all that equipment as well for, again, pennies on the dollar.
That was, so the original Tesla was buying a Lotus, taking the engine out, and filling the floor of the car with batteries, essentially. Mm. And this is where they're actually making the cars, and it's astonishing to drive by. It's gleaming and amazingly huge.
And then, you know, keep going and then you'll get to the Solar City bit and then
right.
the battery factories.
Gigafactory.
And keep driving south and you'll get to SpaceX.
So there's some cool stuff happening out here.
Oh, and by the way, you don't have to drive because he's digging a tunnel between the two.
The Hyperloop, is that really going to...
I'm not sure. I think the tunnel and the Hyperloop are different things.
Oh,
I'm
really?
Sure. Yeah, I'm a little...
I can't keep up.
He's not actually digging a tunnel between the two, but you
it
get
would,
the idea.
It would be fun if he was. So you don't really think about valuation or bubbles, what motivates people who are attracted to this part of the world? What is the driving factor? There are vast riches here, but there's some really cool stuff here. What's the dominant meme out here?
Well, you know, a dominant meme is saying a lot. I mean, I think in general, and it sounds like a cliche. You know, the idea that, and this goes right back to the foundings of Wired, the idea that technology can change the world continues to resonate. You know, Elon Musk is kind of everybody's hero. But, you know, Jeff Bezos and, you know, Larry and Sergey from Google are all in the same category. They are tackling the big problems. Mm-hmm. This is the environment, food, life off the planet, the future of transportation, of energy. I mean, this is like, you know, to say nothing of biotech and medicine and all that.
Right.
People feel like they're doing meaningful work.
It certainly makes a lot of sense. Let's talk about all these private companies that have chosen not to go public. What do you, again, I look at you as somebody who is a astute observer of the technology scene around you. So even if you don't necessarily care about valuation, what do you make of these companies? Go down the list of unicorns that have these huge valuations and just seem to show no interest in IPOing. What's the exit for the VCs, and what is the reluctance to cash out or raise more capital? I guess for someone like Uber, they don't need more capital.
Well, the reluctance to go public is obvious, which is that it's a hassle to be a publicly traded company.
Yeah, but it's how you as an individual get liquid. It's how your backers...
Well, as an individual, there's lots of ways to get
right.
to get liquid. You know, a Travis, you know, does... There's plenty of secondary markets for that.
Mm-hmm.
It is for your employees. It's a little tougher. And you know, there's been a lot of, and you'll probably, you know, Barry, you maybe can advise me on this. There's been all this talk of, like, you know, secondary markets, that you know, liquid secondary markets that could allow people, employees, etc., to get liquid. They've never really come to fruition.
Right.
I'm not sure why.
Well, part of the reason is when you go public, you go through the SEC process. You go through this. And there's a very standard set of ways of you're locked up for this period of time, and now if you want to sell some or all of your stock, here's the methodology. The various secondary markets simply aren't big and deep and liquid enough to do that for every company that wants to go public.
Or doesn't want to go public.
That's right. And then you also end up with the venture capital backers and the original founders who either put up money or sweat equity or both. It's hard to see how they capitalize on the success without going public. So is this, I look at this as a little bit of a coy dance, and Uber will eventually go public, as will Lyft, as will all the other unicorns, or am I, you know, old school?
Well, I wouldn't see the whole thing through the lens of unicorns. I mean, obviously you have a multi-billion-dollar valuation. You know, there aren't a lot of ways to get liquid. But if you have a lower valuation, hundreds of millions or something like that, then M&A is a perfectly reasonable way to do it. And so I would say that you know, there are, when you look at our investors in particular, we have a combination of strategics like Autodesk and Qualcomm and then venture capitalists, they're all looking at creating big value down the line. Either it's, you know, like looking at construction, I mean, we have the opportunity to be part of the, you know, transformation of the second biggest industry in the world. You know, if we get this right, there will be any number of companies that would want to buy us. We may not choose not to sell, but the notion of when you're creating value, you have you open up optionality. That's the thing. Now, you don't want to create your valuation so high that you could have created a lot of value, but there's only like, you know, three companies in the world that could buy you, and they won't, because then you have to go public.
Right.
So it's a delicate balancing act. But if you created value, and if you've taken the time to sort of tackle a big industry.
How far are we from flying robots really being an everyday part of life, ordinary life? You mentioned Bezos. There was a lot of buzz when he talked about using drones as delivery vehicles. How serious is that? Are we eventually going to order something from Amazon and a drone is going to drop it at our house?
Well, you know, so Bezos has the delivery, but there's also Uber and others are talking about air taxis. Mm-hmm. You know, we are talking about, you know, drones on every construction site or every farm, et cetera. You know, of all of those, I think actually seeing drones as a conventional part of, you know, construction or agriculture is probably the nearest. My grandfather was the inventor of the automatic sprinkler system. And he was my inspiration.
The automatic sprinkler system, meaning if I have
timer.
Really?
Yeah. So he was a Swiss engineer in Los Angeles working to bring the talkies.
So you come from a long line of makers, in other words.
Well, one.
two generations back, that's pretty good ancestry for
exactly.
a tinkerer.
Well, it was certainly my inspiration. I spent my summers, I was kind of a rotten kid, and so I was sent to spend my summers with my grandfather. We just spent the summer silently working in the workshop. But what I love about the sprinkler, a sprinkler is my inspiration for drones. You may not think so. You may not see the connection, but a sprinkler is a robot. You know, a modern sprinkler is connected to the internet. It's got sensors. It's, you know, comes up, mechanically does its own thing, goes back in. What I love about it is how boring it is. You just sort of put your sprinklers in. Oh, you live in New York, so you probably...
No, I live in the burbs.
Oh,
I have underground
burbs.
Sprinklers,
okay.
Absolutely.
So you stick them
four
in.
Zones, the rain sensor,
absolutely.
So it doesn't go on when it's raining.
And
it's an interesting little technology.
And it just kind of works, right?
Yeah.
You
take it for granted.
So that is the sign of success. So if someday drones are as boring as sprinklers, which is to say, there's a box. There's a box on the farm. There's a box on the construction site, whatever. And every morning at like, you know, 8:30 a.m., the box opens. It's not a sprinkler coming out, it's a drone coming out. It surveys the
like
site.
A Roomba, it goes
like
home, charges itself, and
exactly.
waits for the next morning. And this whole thing is completely automated.
And I would love it to be covered in mud. I'd like to have stickers, like union stickers on it, something like that. You know, just absolutely conventional construction equipment. And no one cares about it because all they care about is the data.
Right.
And what they know is that every morning they have an up-to-date, super high-resolution 3D, 2D model of the site. They digitized, the site was just automatically digitized in the cloud every day.
Now, that is not something that's decades or years off in the future. That's months or weeks away.
We could do it today.
Today.
The only thing stopping us is that FAA regulations currently require a pilot in command. Now, the pilot... Now, this is the PIC, the pilot in command. Doesn't have to be a pilot. Doesn't actually have to be in command. But there has to be human present. And when I said that the way it works is that you open up your iPad and you just swipe, that swiping act is regulatory.
That's it. You're
it's
in control.
It's required by regulation.
So it can't be. So it can't quite be like a Roomba. Not that I have a Roomba, but the way I understand it is it knows where its home dock is and how to charge. It goes and does its thing, and then it returns, and it does it regularly, like the irrigation system. So
the
regulatory
there.
Reason, you need a human to push a button.
Yeah, so our drones are fully autonomous. They do all that stuff all on their own. The only reason,
including coming back to a charging dock.
It can be. It's a pad, and we don't happen to use the pad because since we have a human there, we might as well use them to change the battery.
Right.
but such a thing exists. You can buy charging docks or pads and things like that. So what we're talking about is autonomy, the notion of taking the human out of the loop, and it's simply a regulatory thing. So we work with the FAA to figure out what would it take to allow them. So like right now it has to be one person, one human, one drone. What about one human, ten drones?
Sure.
What about one human global fleet of drones monitored remotely? Turns out that actually, you know, you can sit there on the ground And you know, you're in command, but you're not. You're checking your email. You're not looking,
right,
et cetera.
You're not paying attention.
The drone's got much better perceptual powers than you have. You're there. It's over there. It has cameras all over the place. It's got sensors. It's got, you know, radar and sonar and LIDAR and all this kind of stuff. How about just let the drone, you know, stay out of harm's way? And if it's got an issue, it can alert you and tell you to pay attention.
Makes sense.
But in the meantime, why don't you do what you're best at, which is, you know,
answering emails.
Whatever it is. Exactly. So that's the process we're going through with the FAA to figure out what sort of evidence they need to allow that kind of autonomy.
And that's – my assumption is that's not all that far off in the future.
No. I mean, I think when you're talking about places like farms, which is private land away from people, I think that's going to be a
low density.
We're talking about going beyond visual line of sight, which is the particular phrase. So I think there's going to be bits where it's accepted first. And when getting back to delivery, you know, the Amazon, you know, original video of delivering in your suburbs, that's hard. Dogs, kids, telephone lines,
trees,
et cetera.
Yeah.
But delivering to a rural area that's quite expensive for the Postal Service to get to,
right,
that actually makes more sense.
Do we have the battery life to send something 50 miles out into a farm and back? It seems
sure, fixed wing on an airplane. You know, so consumer drones or consumer sized drones have flown across the Atlantic.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You know, so it doesn't have to be electric.
Wait, consumer size, like 3 feet across.
Like an airplane that's got a 3 foot, 4 foot wingspan, something like that. It doesn't have to be a battery, but you can use a gas powered engine. So yeah, it's not a problem.
Huh. So I want to talk about one of the TED Talks you did, where you talk about four key stages of viable technology: right price, market share, the displacement of existing technology, and finally becoming ubiquitous. Is that four stage process something that's pretty standard, or do I have the wrong Chris Anderson?
Ha. I get that a lot. So the joke you're making is that the curator of TED is also named Chris Anderson. He and I are
How big
good
of a
friends.
Pain in the neck is having someone else in tech?
1 + 1 = 3. We have a mutual non-destruction pact.
Okay, that's fair.
We promise not to ruin the Chris Anderson brand.
There you go.
We forward each other's misdirected emails without reading it.
Do you guys get each other?
Yeah.
So let me – a quick digression. My last name is spelled O-L-T-Z. We have cousins who don't have the second T. So I have a cousin named Barry Ritholtz, R-I-T-H-O-L-Z. He has a kid brother, Richard, as do I. So there's two Barry and Richie Ritholtzes. At one point in time, we both had offices in 300 Park, and we would get each other's mail, and it was pretty hilarious. Now I'm his nightmare because he has to deal with me in the media, and he's a lawyer at a mutual fund company. So is one of us is a little higher profile than the other. So he has the bigger headache. How does this work with you and Chris Anderson sharing?
Well, there's a basketball player, too.
Right.
But that's spelled E-N, for
sure. So you're both spelled with a C, though.
No, it's identical.
Do you really get each other's... I think he's full on British,
full
though.
On
he
British.
Lived there for a long time.
Yeah,
you were born in London.
Yeah, exactly.
Is this a genuine, like, does genuine confusion happen with this?
But in the best sort of way, which is like people give us credit for each other's work.
Okay.
It's like, you know, Chris, you know, you've done you've written these books, Wired, 3DR, and you run TED. How do you do it? And it's like,
I have a clone.
Sleep. Yeah.
That's hilarious. So the four stages of any viable technology: right price, market share, displacing established tech, and then eventually becoming ubiquitous. Is that the process that we always see with technology, or at least for the foreseeable future?
Sure, Barry. I have to admit, I can't even remember that talk.
Oh, really?
I'm sure it was.
You've done several of them.
Yeah, I'm sure it was inspired. The only reason that talk is on YouTube is that my other talks were abject failures. And it turns out not all talks get put on the website.
Oh, really?
Yeah, my other ones were tech demos.
Right. And Crash and burn. Oh, that's hilarious.
Big time.
We have been speaking with Chris Anderson. He is the founder and CEO of 3D Robotics, as well as the author of The Long Tail, Makers and Free. If you enjoy this conversation, be sure and check out the podcast extras where we keep the tape rolling and continue chatting about all things digital technology. We love your comments, feedback, and suggestions. Write to us at MIBpodcast@bloomberg.net. Follow me on Twitter at Ritholtz. You can see my daily column at BloombergView.com. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You've been listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.
If you're having a business dispute, the process can be slow and drawn out, especially if you rely on litigation in the courts. You can wait for years before your case is resolved, and the longer your case proceeds, the more your case can cost. Not with the American Arbitration Association. Arbitration or mediation with the American Arbitration Association is faster. In fact, nearly 50% of our cases settle prior to hearings. ADR.org. Resolve faster.
Welcome to the podcast, everybody. This is really fascinating stuff. I'm having a great time here. And thank you for the drone I get to take home with.
Yeah, exactly.
Looking forward to crashing that.
The palette of drones that we're sending. and we didn't get to do a demo either.
I'll be late going into the city.
I don't have time, but if you want to hang around, the team will happily give you a demo.
I have to be somewhere at 12:30, but I would love to. And I mean, we watched them take off and land before, and it was just the return to home to land. It literally lands on the same square inch where it took off from. It's amazing. So let's get through some of these standard questions before you have to head into the city. The most interesting thing that people don't know about your background?
Failed out of college and played in punk rock bands for most of my 20s.
Where'd you go to school?
Well, I failed. I ultimately went to school at George Washington and studied at UC Berkeley, which is where we are here as well. I failed out of a school I won't mention.
Okay.
But the cool bit is
why is that? Why won't you mention it? Just because
it's not fair to the school.
It was on you. It wasn't on them.
Yeah.
Okay. But ultimately, you got a college degree?
Yeah, no, I was playing punk rock bands. So I was a bicycle messenger by day.
Right.
And at age like 27, finally get back to school and get a degree. I was such a mess up that I decided to do the hardest thing possible just to convince people that I actually had a brain. So that's why I did physics. But the cool bit is that one of the bands I played in was called R.E.M.
But not that R.E.M.
But not that R.E.M. And we had a very funny. We released our albums on the same week, and
this coincidental?
Yeah,
or were you
total
like?
Coincidence.
I mean, who knew who REM was?
Well, they were like these hicks from the sticks, Georgia, and we were like the coolest band in Washington D.C. I know,
right?
And it's a bit of a non sequitur there.
Right.
And so our manager thought it'd be funny to have a battle of the REMs, where the winner got to rename the loser.
And did that ever happen?
It did indeed.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And what did they rename you, I'm going to assume?
They renamed us, a good assumption. They renamed us Egoslavia.
That's hilarious.
Under which name we released our only album.
Egoslavia. Oh, my God. That's hilarious. So let's talk about some of your early mentors, one of which I have to assume is your grandfather after the story you told
absolutely.
Us.
Absolutely. Fred Hauser, Swiss immigrant, L.A., you know, by day working in the film industry, bring sound to, bring the talkies in. And by night, I'm inventing the automatic sprinkler system, which, by the way, is exactly what a Swiss engineer in L.A. would do. L.A.'s greening the desert.
Right.
A Swiss engineer would put a clock on the sprinkler.
Did he make a fortune in this, or was it one of those things that the patent did nothing?
Small fortune.
All right. Hey, better than no fortune.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Who else, any other mentors affected the way you think about either technology or writing?
Wired and its founders had a huge influence on me. So, Kevin Kelly in particular, his book,
Out of Control.
Well, Cool Tools is what he's, one of the things he's known for. But one of his original books, Out of Control. So earlier in the conversation, we were talking about emergence and the notion of capitalism and democracy and the internet being essentially emergent, phenomena. Out of Control extends that to biological and more kind of natural examples. I mean, the notion of emergent phenomena, the notion that there's some general principles, physics or chemistry, whatever, that just set these rules, and then everything else, all the life and civilization emerges from these principles. That was one of the most influential ideas of my formative years.
Interesting. Let's talk about who else influenced your approach to writing. Because you are quite an accomplished writer, not just three books. You're a very influential writer who shaped your approach to that aha moment and then turning it into, hey, this is an article in a magazine. Oh, no, there's more here. Let's turn this into a book.
So I don't think of myself. I mean, thank you for saying that. My parents were writers, and so I promised I'd do everything but that, and I failed once again.
We become our parents. There's no way to avoid it. And
despite everything.
Genetics actually is a thing.
I don't think of myself as a writer. I think of myself as a guy who can sort of capture ideas and get them out there. So as an editor, of course, you're not typically writing. You're just packaging ideas. As companies package ideas, open source communities package ideas, and writing is one way to do it. I think that perhaps the most influential writer for me was Nicholas Negroponte in his original book, Being Digital. Which very early days, but sweeping notions that digital was different, that it almost had kind of fundamental physical properties, and I think that was probably. I mean, I haven't read it for years, but I can't tell you whether it's well written or not, but it was very powerful ideas.
So, since you brought up books, probably the question we get asked more than any other is, "Hey, what are your guests' favorite books?" So, you mentioned Being Digital. What other books have you found to be important, influential, valuable to you, fiction, nonfiction, technology, non-tech, it doesn't matter.
Yeah. Well, recently I've been reading, I had this rule for 30 years I would only read nonfiction. The books, the Kevin Kellys of the world. Recently I've been reading fiction again, but only science fiction, on the grounds that it's I can almost justify it because there's, it's kind of a vision of the future.
Hey, here's where tech is going.
Right? I mean, the Three Body Problems series.
By who?
Now you're asking. It's Chinese author, and it's something Lee. We can look it up.
Body Problems.
The Three Body Problems series. Mm-hmm. It is the most exciting science fiction. If you liked.
Really?
Yeah. So there's the first one was The Three Body Problem. The second one was The Dark Forest. And the third one, his name is escaping me. But
I'll be able to look. With those two, I can.
Yeah. And is Quinley something? No, it's not Quinley. I can't remember exactly. But what's cool is that the author, by day, he's an engineer in a power plant in the middle of China, and by night he writes the most exciting kind of mind expanding science fiction about what would the universe be like if there were how would we encounter life, why haven't we encountered life, how would we communicate, anyway, it's
Cixin Liu, CIXINLIU. The Three Body Problem, The Dark Forest, Remembrance of Earth's Past, and Death's End.
Yeah.
Are those the three?
Those are the three.
I'm going to put that on the list. That sounds fascinating.
Yeah.
Is this Fermi's paradox? Is that what he's describing, or something more forward than that?
So one notion, the most interesting thing, I don't want to ruin the plot, but the Dark Forest, the middle one, sort of explains the notion that if you know that there's another species out there, you assume that sooner or later they're going to kill you.
Right.
And so it's really important that you that they not know you exist.
Okay.
And he kind of walks through the logic. But,
so we shouldn't be broadcasting television signals into space.
Precisely. And so the reason that, the case there is that the reason we haven't encountered other civilizations is because they're hiding. Because they know that we
know. That's a fascinating concept. I like that. Any other books you want to mention?
I hate to keep using the Kevin Kelly examples. Those are the ones I'm reading right now. There's a new book. Those are the ones I'm gonna highlight for now.
Okay. We talked about changes in the technology industry. We talked about shifts in. Let me briefly ask you about the digital shift in journalism and the problem that genuine media outlets are having competing with free and digital. How big of a problem is that for the idea of a free press in America when that business model is under attack from everywhere?
So I'm always baffled by that question. I get it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
There is no shortage of media. It's the golden age of media. Now we call that media Facebook, or we call it, the web, or we call it social media. But there's, we now have access to global media.
Mm-hmm. I get the FT every day.
There you go. And digitally as well. So it's very hard to believe there's any kind of suppression of media for economic reasons. I mean, basically the cost of creating and distributing content is very low. So when people talk about the free press, it's a very archaic, almost American notion of the fourth estate. I mean, no other country has this sort of, maybe some other countries, but in general, this notion that, that you have these kind of, natural monopolies, big city newspapers who are necessary to counterbalance political forces. Very weird, very American, very 20th century. Doesn't seem relevant today.
Tell us about a time you failed and what you learned from the experience.
Where do I start? In our progression at 3DR from the technology to the consumer electronics to the tool using drones as sensors, because of regulation, the regulation only allowed recreational use. So the only way, we couldn't do commercial use until September of last year. And so in between, the only way you could really, get drones out there was on the shelves of Walmart. And and so we raised a lot of money, and we spun up, outsourced manufacturing and consumer electronics, and, perhaps the most complex consumer electronics device, ever at that time. And we decided to do the consumer pack, products. Thing right with distribution and marketing and retail shelves and all that. And we designed a good product, and we did everything right. That's when the prices fell by 70% in 9 months. And we ended up with negative margins. Mm-hmm. Pebble.
Your units cost $600-$800 to build.
Yeah, exactly. So when we started, the going price for an advanced drone was about $1,500, $1,600, even more. Mm-hmm. And so, our bill of materials was about half that, which is appropriate. Wow. By the time a couple months after we launched, the going price was below our bill of materials, and as of like about a year ago, it was down to about $300. These were not bad technologies.
These are not toys. These are serious things.
Exactly.
So what did you learn from that? What was the takeaway?
I learned that, my instinct right now is that essentially it was the universe telling me what should have been obvious, which is that Silicon Valley should focus on software.
Uh-huh.
China's extraordinarily good at hardware. The notion of advanced Silicon Valley cloud software running on Chinese hardware, which, by the way, is your phone.
Right, exactly.
is the way we should go. And it's kind of like, don't fight it. It's, rather than build your own hardware, go find some brilliant company in China that's making the hardware and partner.
Let them have all the costs and produce it at half.
And every time I talk to, a new company in Silicon Valley that's doing hardware, they're like, yeah, we know that the hardware is commoditizing. We know the Chinese, but we think we have 5 to 7 years. And it's like, yeah, I said that too.
You got 6 months. What do you do to keep either mentally or physically fit? And what do you do to relax outside of the office?
So physically fit, I just play tennis. Mm-hmm. But I have some of my dear friends and mentors are my tennis partners, and so tennis is not about the tennis.
Right.
It's about spending time with your friends you wouldn't otherwise schedule. Intellectually, I still have tons of hobbies. And 10 years ago, we did DIY drones. Now we're doing DIY robocars and applying the same sort of grassroots bottom. What if you made an autonomous car for $100? Now it wouldn't carry a person. In the same way a drone doesn't carry a person, but it's the same. It's LiDAR, computer vision, neural networks, Google Cloud software.
And this is now down to the DIY level. The various, at one point in time, this was a, was it a DARPA contest?
The DARPA competition, the Grand Challenge, et cetera. So this weekend, for example, we're going to be doing robot-to-robot, wheel-to-wheel autonomous car racing in a huge warehouse, like semi-abandoned warehouse in Oakland, California. And then we're going to do robot versus human. And this is not; these are not toys. I mean, they look like toys because they're like in a 1/10 scale, but it's exact same technology as in a Tesla or any.
They could scale right up if they
scale had to. Right up. It's basically using the same Google, neural network stuff. But the cost of the hardware itself is about $100, $150, and we made it so it's fun. We made it so that a student could do it. And, you know, it's dangerous for the cars, but not for humans.
Right. These are, they're truly autonomous. You basically 3, 2, 1 go and...
There's one just outside this room.
We're going to have to take a look at that. Now I have to ask my final two questions. First, what sort of advice would you give to a millennial or someone just starting their career in either technology or journalism?
So, you know, I have kids who are just going to college or soon will.
Local or elsewhere?
No, they refuse to go locally. In the same way they refuse to do drones.
Why did I know that? No, yeah. That was the answer.
I mean, we live in Berkeley. You know, you see Berkeley is like one of the best schools in the world, but they just won't go to it. I didn't get in either, but they didn't apply. In fairness, they didn't apply. You know, if you ask me what I was to study today, I'm going to give you an answer which sounds boring, and then mm-hmm. we have to find a sexier way to sell it. The answer is statistics.
Probability and statistics are not boring at all.
But it doesn't sound super compelling. So let's call it something sexier. Let's call it data science.
I'm going to take it a step further. Probability and statistics is how you discern reality from falsity, truth from nonsense.
And, so sell it to my 17-year-old.
I can't tell you how often something comes along and you say, no, that's – you're giving me a sample set of two. Who cares? It's not – if you don't know that, you cannot identify reality.
So my 17-year-old is trying to choose a major.
Mm-hmm.
And you, Barry, Uncle Barry, as we'll call you for the purpose of this argument, are going to convince my 17-year-old to major in what you just said.
Mm-hmm.
Sell it in a way that doesn't sound like spinach.
Well, what do you want to do with your life? What are you interested in? How would you like to have a way to identify what's real and what's false in that? How would you like to be able to inject a truth serum into anything that takes place in meat space and some stuff that takes place in the virtual world and figure out if it's real or it's false?
And what if they say, it sounds hard, and is it even a job?
Anything that's worth doing is hard, number one, and it's a job, but it's only a fabulous, paying, fascinating job. So if that's of interest, you know, the ability to – and by the way, this is a well-established science. Many people have problems with it, but the ability to walk in and look at something and say, here's how we know their story is false based on this, is an amazing, amazing thing. And I'm astonished more people don't recognize it for what it is.
So I agree with everything you just said. The way I ended up selling it was I said, well, okay, let's call it computer science and – let's call it data science. So data science is basically computer science plus statistics mm-hmm. of various sorts. One of my sons is at Northwestern and he did economics or econometrics
right.
and computer science, which is another way to –
huge overlap between the two.
Huge overlap. Sure. And so when you put econometrics and computer science together, if the employers want to see that as data science – data science
Great.
It is. And that's a very hot profession. You can get paid for that.
Sure, to say the least. Our final question before I make you late for your next appointment. What is it that you know about technology, writing, journalism today you wish you knew 25 years ago?
I mean, I've been pretty lucky in being in the right place at the right time throughout. Sometimes being too early is bad as being wrong, mm-hmm. and I've certainly been too early on some things. I think I might have. So I could have moved to Silicon Valley sooner,
mm-hmm.
But in that, if I'd done so, I would have missed China. I would have missed being in China at the
and
moment
that's a
it was
cool
emerging.
Thing to have experienced.
And that was cooler. I guess I would have. The only time I regret is the time I spent in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. I was too long in Washington. I saw the world through kind of a political lens, and I wish I'd gotten out of there sooner. Here in Silicon Valley, D.C. feels a long way away. Governments seem not terribly – not as important mm-hmm. as markets, and even countries don't seem as important as trade relationships.
Mm-hmm.
So I wish I'd traveled sooner.
We have been speaking with Chris Anderson, CEO of 3D Robotics, author of The Long Tail and Makers and Free. If you enjoy this conversation, be sure and look up an inch or down an inch on either Apple iTunes, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and you could see our other 150 or so such recordings. I would be remiss if I did not thank Michael Batnick, who helped prepare these questions, Chris Venn, who has been my boy Friday on this trip. And Chris, thank you so much for being so generous with your time. I know you have other things and better places to do and be. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. Masters in Business is brought to you by the American Arbitration Association. Business disputes are inevitable. Resolve faster with the American Arbitration Association, the global leader in alternative dispute resolution for over 90 years. Learn more at ADR.org.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.